When I was little, I loved watermelons. I just thought they were the coolest fruit. I think it was because how you could spit the seeds. That's probably what did it for me. But I just loved watermelons. Now it's cool because my kids love watermelons, only they call them juicy melons. And we try and correct them, but they say, no, mommy, no, daddy, it's juicy melons. And so that's the way it is. And I actually kind of like it because it's really more like juice than water inside anyway. So I think they've stumbled upon something. But anyway, I loved watermelons, and when I was a kid, my parents, who are here this morning, so you could verify this story with them if you'd like, they let me plant some watermelons in a little patch that we had outside of our house. So I was really excited about this. I went to the grocery store, I got a little packet of watermelon seeds, and I planted these seeds, and I watered them, and I cared for them, and I watched and waited. Pretty soon, some little green shoots came up, and I was all excited, and pretty soon after that, there were some little tiny green balls on those shoots, and I was just more excited, and I couldn't wait for these little tiny green balls to turn into great big green watermelons, and I waited, and I waited, and it just never happened. My parents figured it out, and they broke the news to me that I had planted watermelons, but somehow there was a mix-up, and what came up was Brussels sprouts. So there I was as a kid, waiting for juicy melons, and I got Brussels sprouts. I didn't even know what Brussels sprouts were until that point, and nobody in my family liked them, so we had to give them to the neighbors so somebody would eat these things. So I was disappointed. As a kid, I was disappointed by that. This morning, we're going to talk about disappointment. So prepare for disappointment. That's our message this morning. What a great image, huh? Hopefully we're not that disappointed, but we'll see. To get us thinking, I have a clip from a movie, Bruce Almighty, that we're going to watch to kind of think about how we react to disappointment. In this clip, Bruce has just been passed up for a major promotion. He's lost his job after humiliating himself. And most recently, he's been beaten up by some street thugs. So let's watch how Bruce responds to disappointment and see if it's a good model or maybe not so much. Let's watch the clip.
Just get a clue!
Well, thank God you're all right.
God, yeah, let's thank God, shall we? For his blessings are raining down upon me. Wait, that's not rain!
Bruce, please don't do that, honey. You know that everything happens for a reason.
That I don't need. That is a cliche. That is not helpful to me. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. I have no bird. I have no bush. God has taken my bird and my bush.
Oh, I see. So God is picking on you? Is that what you're saying?
No, he's ignoring me completely. He's far too busy giving Evan everything he wants. Oh, that's great, Sam. But you missed your target. I'm over here!
Don't get mad at the dog. It's not the dog's fault.
No, it's God's fault. You gave him the wrong coordinates.
You know what? Enough. All right? Will you just stop being such a martyr?
I am not being a martyr. I'm a victim. God is a mean kid sitting on an anthill with a magnifying glass, and I'm the ant. He could fix my life in 5 minutes if he wanted to, but he'd rather burn off my feelers and watch me squirm!
All right, sweetheart, I know that you're mad. It's completely understandable. What Evan did is slimy and wrong. But this day could have been so much worse. I'm just glad you're okay.
Okay? Newsflash! I'm not okay. I'm not okay with a mediocre job. I'm not okay with a mediocre apartment. I'm not okay with a mediocre life!
So what do you think? Good model or not so much? Well, Bruce allowed his disappointment to turn into anger against God and to demand that God treat him better. His disappointment led to demand. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, we might agree that that same thing happens for us. Maybe not quite as dramatic as Bruce's outburst, but the same thing can be true of our hearts. Well, this is also what happened for the remnant of Israelites living in Jerusalem as they were called to rebuild the temple. And this is what Haggai addresses in his third message. So let's turn to Haggai and we'll find out how God responded to their demand of disappointment and what he might be saying to us this morning about our hearts. If you remember, Haggai is a collection of four sermons that the prophet Haggai delivered to the people of God over the course of several months. And they'd come back to Jerusalem to resettle the land and rebuild the temple. The task before them was to rebuild the temple of God, which we've been talking about as the physical, visible manifestation of the presence of God in their midst. The temple made God real to them. So they were called to rebuild the temple so they could more fully experience the reality of God's presence among them. But they faltered, and they got frustrated, and they stopped working. This halfway built wall up here on stage with us is reminding us of the uncomfortableness of incompleteness. How something that's unfinished just calls out to be done, to be finalized. So Haggai gives his people four messages to motivate them to complete what they started. We're going to look at the third message today. It's found in Haggai 2, verses 10 through 19. Again, Haggai is the third to last book of the Old Testament. So if you don't know where Haggai is, you can go to Matthew and flip back a few pages. And we're in Haggai 2, 10 through 19. Well, I have to say at the start here that this passage is probably the most difficult passage in Haggai to study. There's several places in the Hebrew text where the Hebrew doesn't seem to make sense. There are words that aren't used anywhere else in the Bible. They're hard to translate. There are some awkward phrases that don't seem to fit where they're placed. There are some places where somebody's being referred to or some time period, but it's not sure what or where. So what scholars like to do, they come up with various theories to solve these problems. And the leading theory right now is that this passage, part of this passage, actually belongs immediately after chapter 1. A very early error was made in a copy of the Bible that was never recovered, and we don't have any of the right versions. Now, there's no physical evidence to support this, but somebody came up with this theory, and everybody likes it, and everybody's kind of gone along with it. I don't agree with that theory, but I bring it up to point out to you that this is a tricky passage. There's some hard stuff going on here that sometimes isn't real clear. So I'm going to share with you what I'm convinced of after having studied the passage and what I've come to, but know that there's other opportunities, there's other things out there that might be true of this, and there are some other viable interpretations. Well, our passage begins with a legal quiz from God. He asks the people in Jerusalem some basic questions about the way the Mosaic Law works. So let's look, and we'll start in verse 10. On the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Haggai. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Ask the priests what the law says. If a person carries consecrated meat in the fold of his garment, and that fold touches some bread or stew, some wine, oil, or other food, does it become consecrated? The priest answered, no. Then Haggai said, if a person defiled by contact with a dead body touches one of things, does it become defiled? Yes, the priest replied, it becomes defiled. Then Haggai said, so it is with this people and this nation in my sight, declares the Lord. Whatever they do and whatever they offer there is defiled. So the first legal test has to do with whether when something clean touches something unclean, does the unclean thing get clean? The obvious answer is no. It's like asking, if I'm sick and you're healthy and you cough on me, do I get better? We know that that's not the way the world works. In this world, disease is contagious, not health. Health isn't contagious. Well, the second legal test is basically the inverse of the first. If you become unclean by touching a dead body, and then you touch something else, does what you touch then become unclean? The obvious answer is yes. This is what we're familiar with. This is how the world works. Disease spreads. Dirtiness wins. In a battle between cleanness and uncleanness, uncleanness is always going to win. In the game of life, dirt, disease, and disorder don't play fair. They spread. Dirt wins. Well, what immediately strikes me about this passage is the way that God is interacting with his people. This is God, the King of the universe, creator of heavens and earth, coming down to interact with his people on a very personal level. He's asked them to rebuild the temple, and they've stopped. But he doesn't just rebuke them. He tries to explain to them what's going on. He deals with their hearts. Makes me think of my four-year-old daughter and how often she corrects me. And what's amazing to me is this started probably over a year ago, before she was 3 years old. I'd say something and she'd come up and say, no, Daddy, that's not the way it is. Let me explain to you how it is. And this was amazing to me because at this point in her life, pretty much everything she knew about the world, all of the information that she had accumulated, had come from me or my wife. So I find myself wondering, what source of knowledge is she drawing from to determine that I'm wrong and she's right? She has no other body of knowledge. And yet, I listen to her. I come down and I hear what she has to say, and I explain things to her in a way that she can understand. And I love interacting with her on that level. I love her audaciousness. I love trying to figure out a way to explain things that she might be able to grasp. So this is what God is doing. He's interacting with his people in a way that communicates to them in simple language what everybody knows. In a fight between clean and dirty, dirty wins. That's just the way the world works. Well, then God concludes that based on this principle, his people are unclean. See, they're a mix of obedience and disobedience. But what God is saying is, don't think that your obedience erases your disobedience. Don't think that because you've been faithful and started back to work on the temple, that means that wipes out your former disobedience. Don't think that the clean thing of getting back to work erases the unclean thing of your heart. Don't think that your obedience guarantees blessing. One of the reasons this passage in Haggai is so difficult to study is that there's a word used in verse 13, a Hebrew word that God uses to refer to Israel that almost always in the rest of the Old Testament is used to refer to the Gentile nations. When God says this nation in talking about Israel, he's putting them in a category that his people usually aren't placed in. It's like when a child paints on the wall, and when the father comes home, the mother says, look at what your son did today. It's no longer our son in this situation. Now it's your son. God doesn't talk about his people here as his people. In verse 13, he says, verse 14, this people and this nation, he excludes them. He sees them on the outside. So that's why a lot of people think this passage can't be referring to Israel. But I think they're wrong. I think it is referring to Israel, and God's using very strong language to make a very important point. That on the whole, these people are still disobedient. On the whole, they're still unclean. Don't think your disobedience is wiped out by your obedience. Obedience doesn't guarantee blessing. Obedience doesn't guarantee blessing. Well, let's remember back to what's been going on for these people. They're back in Jerusalem. God has asked them to rebuild the temple. They started and they stopped. 4 months earlier, Haggai gave them a message to get back to work, and they obeyed a month later. So presumably for the past 3 months, they've been working on the temple. But what we find out from the next part of this passage is that things didn't change immediately. Let's pick up this section and we'll read from verse 15 through the beginning of 19. Haggai says, now give careful thought to this from this day on. Consider how things were before one stone was laid on another in the Lord's temple. When anyone came to a heap of 20 measures, there were only 10. When anyone went to a wine vat to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. I struck all the works of your hands with blight, mildew, and hail. Yet you did not turn to me, declares the Lord. From this day on, from this 24th day of the ninth month, give careful thought to the day when the foundation of the Lord's temple was laid. Give careful thought. Is there yet any seed left in the barn? Until now, the vine and the fig tree, the pomegranate and the olive tree have not borne fruit. So we get to the heart of the disappointment that was driving these Israelites. They'd gotten back to work on the temple, but the drought was still there. They'd done what God asked them to. Why didn't he respond in the way they thought he would? If their disobedience had caused the drought, why hadn't their obedience ended it? I think we can probably understand their frustration. I think in the same circumstance, we'd probably feel pretty much the same. I know I would. But I think it's because of the way that we think relationships work, particularly our relationship with God. We tend to want our relationships to be fair. We tend to want equality on all sides of our relationships. But what Haggai teaches us is a simple lesson that's really tricky to learn. Relationships aren't fair. They're free. Relationships aren't fair. They're free. This is the lesson that the remnant has to learn. This is the lesson that we have to learn. What's amazing is that even as I'm learning this lesson, I'm responsible to teach this lesson to my children. This comes up for my kids when they want something. We touched on this in our children's sermon this morning. Their natural response to wanting something is to demand it. So it might go something like this. My kids will come up and they'll say, "Daddy, give me a cookie now." And I'll say, "No, you can't have a cookie because you didn't ask nicely." So they'll think about that, and the next day they'll come up and they'll try and ask nicely. So they'll come and they'll say, "Father, would you in your abundant kindness please grant my request for a delicious cookie?" And I'll say, "Thank you so much for asking nicely. That was beautiful. But I'm sorry the answer is no because we've had too much dessert today already." And inevitably their response will be, "But I asked nicely. I asked nicely." See, they understand that they don't get what they want if they don't ask nicely. And so they assume that the way to get what they want is to ask nicely. And if they've asked nicely and they still haven't gotten what they want, then this relationship is unfair. This is not the way things are supposed to work. They played by the rules. Why haven't they gotten what they wanted? And the truth is that the relationship isn't fair. As a parent, I'm tasked with making decisions that pretty frequently don't give my kids exactly what they want. And that isn't fair. But they're learning a lesson about relationships. They're learning that relationships aren't fair, but they're free. Not asking nicely guarantees that they won't get what they want. But asking nicely doesn't guarantee that they do get what they want. It only allows for the possibility. It gives me, as the parent, the freedom then to consider their request and decide what's best in this case. But often when they ask nicely, they aren't trying to give me the freedom to make a decision. They're trying to do the right thing so they can get what they want out of the situation. But it doesn't work that way because relationships aren't fair. They're free. So this demand of disappointment that lives deep within our hearts is the issue that Haggai is addressing in the remnant of Israel. The insistence that God respond to us the way we think he ought to, based on what we deserve. The demand that he treat us the way we think we should be treated because of our obedience. Well, how is this true for you? What disappointment do you feel? Disappointment is one of the inevitable things that we have to feel in life. And it's hard. It hurts to hope for something and have that hope not come through. What is it for you? What's your disappointment? Maybe you've been wanting to have a child for a long time and that hasn't happened. Maybe you're disappointed about not getting into a certain school or not getting a job that you really wanted. Maybe it's losing a match in sports or not making the team or the club that you really wanted to be on. Maybe it's your health that you've been battling or your relationships. Maybe your husband or your wife just didn't turn out to be the way you thought they would be. Or your children have made choices that you know to be destructive and you're just so disappointed in the midst of that. For me, I had to face a big disappointment in the middle of seminary. Rachel and I had realized that my working from home was putting a bit of a strain on our marriage. So we decided that my being gone when I'm gone and home when I'm home would have been a better pattern for us. So I looked around for a different job, and I found an opportunity to work for a company with the same software product that I was currently developing in my existing job. They were going to let me work half-time so I could go to school. Their office was a few miles from where my house was. They were going to pay me almost twice what I was currently making. Everything just seemed perfect. I talked to the manager, and he said, "Yeah, we've decided on hiring you. We just have to wait to get the approvals through, so we have to pass them up kind of through the chain." And that dragged out a little bit longer and a little bit longer. And finally, I got the call that the approvals came through, and we decided to hire somebody else. I remember I was at lunch with a friend when I got that phone call on my cell phone, so I kind of shrugged it off a little bit. But when I got home, I just cried and cried in disappointment. What was I to do now? Could I survive seminary, the rest of seminary, working from home? Could my marriage and my family? The danger of disappointment is that it can turn into demand. It can turn into my demanding that God treat me a certain way because I deserve it. And then, because of the pain of our disappointment, we no longer trust ourselves to God. Since our demand was denied, we declare our indifference. With our demand denied, we declare our indifference. And we either walk away from God entirely, or our hearts turn cold and hard toward Him. But the truth is that we are learning a lesson. We're learning about relationship. We're learning that if we're going to persist in an ongoing relationship with a really real God, we have to get over the idea that relationships are fair. We have to get over the idea that relationships are built on give and take and compromise. And you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours. We have to get over the idea that if I keep up my end of the bargain, then God has to keep up His end of the bargain. That's not a relationship, that's a business arrangement. Relationships aren't built on equal opportunity and fair play. They're built on love and grace. Relationships aren't fair, they're free. Love isn't fair, it's free. 2 weeks ago, when we began this series on Haggai, we reflected as a community on some ways that God has made Himself real to us. We passed out some cards and we asked you to answer the question, what is one of the physical, visible manifestations of the presence of God in your life? I read some of these last week. I'd like to read some more. And what I want you to notice is the theme of relationship that weaves through these. Unmerited favor, unconditional love, acceptance, grace from other people in my life. Times when we've looked to Him in prayer and we see Him respond in an obvious and real way, when we can attribute the response to nothing other than God. At the side of my father's deathbed, he has been suffering for months after struggling with a deadly disease for years. On his last night, I prayed, God, if you really exist, please end your son's suffering. God answered my prayer 2 hours later. When others love me and forgive me unconditionally, it's incredibly humbling and so unlike our human nature that I see the Lord's mercy, grace, and love within it. It's like the Lord is saying, I love you, I love you, I love you. The miracle of adoption, God putting us together as a family. The godly legacy of my mother and father. Sisters in Christ that I pray with every week. Singing in a choir, singing the Messiah, playing in orchestra. God's faithfulness in my relationships with others, His presence and leading through good times and really hard times, especially looking back on these times. The birth of my daughter that has brought so much joy into my life. When my wife forgives me for something I have done. And what I've noticed is how powerful relationship seems to be in making God seem real to us. But not just any kind of a relationship. Does God seem real to us when I pay a dollar and get a soda in return? Does God seem real to us when I do something nice for my wife on the condition that she do something nice for me in return? Or does God seem real when we're forgiven for something really stupid we did? Or when we're treated in a way with grace that we know we don't deserve to be treated? See, God seems real when we experience forgiveness, grace, and mercy. We're made for relationships that are free. So whenever we relate to anyone, I think we do so according to how we perceive relationships to work. Whether we're relating to God, our parents, our spouses, our family, friends, children. So as we begin to recognize the demand of disappointment in our hearts, in our relationship with God, we're going to see it in our relationships with others as well. in our marriages, our friendships. And it'll break our hearts. But as we begin to grasp that relationships aren't fair, they're free. And as we begin to live in the freedom of a real relationship built on love and grace, we'll see that start to infect all of our relationships with God, with each other, in this church, in our neighborhoods. And we'll grow in forgiveness, love, and grace with God and with each other. Well, if our relationship with God isn't fair, then how does He treat us? Why should we persist in a relationship with this God if it isn't fair? Why should we persist in a relationship with God if He doesn't give us what we want, even when we ask nicely? The last section I want us to look at is the end of verse 19. From this day on, I will bless you. Four simple words. I will bless you. God began by teaching His people a legal lesson. Dirtiness corrupts cleanliness. He concluded that His people are unclean. Their disobedience still makes them unclean. And He pointed out that He didn't give them what they wanted. He didn't take away the drought as soon as they started working on the temple, because He can't be manipulated. But then He surprises them. Out of nowhere, from this day on, I will bless you. Even though you are unclean, even though you can't earn my blessing, even though I don't have to bless you just because you started building the temple, even though, from this day on, I will bless you. I will bless you. I will bless you. Because this is how God treats His people. Not because He has to, not because they've kept up their end of the bargain, so He has to keep up His end to make it fair. Not because they built a temple, or asked nicely, or went to church, or gave a lot of money, or didn't drink, or did any of the things that we assume might get God to treat us the way we want to be treated. But because He is God, and He is a God who blesses. So at the end of this passage, we learn a simple but very important truth. God will bless us. Not on our terms, but God will bless us. It may not look the way we want it to look, but God will bless us. And this is the surprise of a relationship with God. A relationship with God that isn't fair, but it's free. We think that all we want is for God to treat us fairly. But as it turns out, if we're treated fairly, then we're still stuck as unclean. As it turns out, we're much better off being treated freely rather than fairly. Because the freedom of our relationship with God means that He blesses us. The freedom of a relationship with God is that He sacrifices Himself for our sake. In fact, there's an interesting story in the Gospels where this is kind of all comes to light. We learned in Haggai that dirtiness pollutes cleanness. Dirt wins. And yet there's this funny story from Jesus' life. He's walking along the road. He's going to heal a little girl. The father of the girl had come to Him and begged Him to please come heal my daughter. So He starts walking. But along the way, somewhere in the crowd, there's a woman who's had a medical condition for years that's caused her to bleed continually. So in addition to the medical problem and the pain caused by her condition, she's always unclean. Her blood makes her always unclean. Always prohibited from touching anybody else. Always excluded from the life of the community. Always rejected. Always alone. Always unclean. So in a desperate act of hope, she comes up behind Jesus and she touches His robe, thinking that might heal her. But why would she think this? That's not the way the Mosaic Law works. Dirtiness pollutes cleanness. It doesn't work the other way around. Jesus is a holy man. For an unclean woman to touch Him would make Him unclean, not the reverse. And yet, she hoped in a relationship that wasn't fair. And she touched the edge of His robe. And she was healed. In this case, health won. In this case, wholeness was contagious. Power flowed out from Jesus, and she was healed. The cleanness of Jesus overcame her uncleanness. Jesus' health became her health. And that's how God treats us. Jesus' health becomes our health. Jesus' life becomes our life. God will bless us. We have to learn the lesson that in our lives, dirtiness wins. We have to learn the truth that our obedience doesn't guarantee our blessing. We have to learn the truth that we can't manipulate God and that we hope He won't give us what we want just because we ask nicely. We have to face the hurt of disappointment and feel the pain of demands denied. But all of this prepares us for a message of hope. All of this prepares us to enter into a relationship with God that isn't fair, but it is free. And the freedom is God's blessing in our life. Do you believe that God will bless you? How is your heart toward God right now? Are you disappointed with Him? Do you feel that you've been treated unfairly? Or have you just kind of stopped expecting anything from Him? Do you believe that God will bless you? We're going to talk more about hope next week and why it's hard to have hope and what it looks like to have hope. But for this week, we want to look at what it looks like to relate to God freely. Well, my children are learning that they can't manipulate me into getting what they want. Most of the time. Just because they ask nicely doesn't mean that they will get what they want. But they're also learning that Daddy loves them in surprising ways. The other day I went to our freezer where we keep our cookies, and I got out a cookie, and I went to my oldest daughter, Ellie, and I gave her a cookie. She looked up at me and said, "Daddy, why are you giving me a cookie?" See, in her world, it didn't make sense. In her world of relationships that are built on getting what you deserve and earning what you get, it didn't make sense that I was just giving her a cookie. She hadn't even asked nicely. But she's still learning about freedom in a relationship. Just like I'm still learning about freedom in a relationship. Just like you're still learning about freedom in a relationship. My answer to her was simply, "Because I love you." And she didn't understand about freedom in a relationship. She didn't get the big picture, but she was just happy to have a cookie. And so we sat on the couch together and we enjoyed our cookies together. Well, we've walked through what can be a difficult to understand section of Haggai. But we've seen God teaching His people a lesson that we're all in the process of learning. Just like Bruce in our clip responded to disappointment with demand, we can tend to do that. We can turn against God and declare that we've been treated unfairly. But we're slowly learning to relate to God out of freedom, not fairness. We're slowly learning to relate to each other out of freedom, not fairness. We're slowly learning to relate to the world in freedom, not just fairness. And that's what this message in Haggai is. It's a message of hard lessons learned. It's a message of facing disappointment and having our demands denied. But ultimately, it's a message of hope. Because God will bless His people. God will bless His people. God will bless us.